This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So we're going to talk about the Aziz Ansari, Grace, Babe.net story and all that it's unleashed. And I'm going to guess that it's already lit up your social media feeds. So here, let me just put the phone number out right now because we really want to hear your reaction. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to talk about what you make of the Aziz Ansari, Babe.net story. You can also send me a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, a little bit of background for those of you who haven't seen this in your social media feed. Babe.net's article has a headline. It grabs your attention. The headline is, "I went on a date with Aziz Ansari. It turned into the worst night of my life." The story then delves into pretty awful detail about Ansari's sexual behavior with a young woman named Grace. That's her pseudonym. There is so much to talk about right there, about communication and intimacy, about power and responsibility and who holds both of those things, and about the Me Too movement and the backlash against Me Too. So on that point, let me just offer you a quote from Margaret Atwood, who recently wrote, quote, "A war among women is always pleasing to those who do not wish women well." Which is why I want to make another point before introducing our guests, because we also have to talk about the journalistic malpractice that this story represents and the fact that the company that published it is run by a man who also publishes The Tab, a site whose UK outlets regularly run a, quote, "rear of the year competition." You can guess what that's all about. Oh, and by the way, it's also funded by Rupert Murdoch, whose tabloids have cashed in on the exploitation of women and the titillation of the general public for decades. So yeah, I am worked up about all of this. Joining me now are some very smart women who are going to try and help me make sense of it. Here to talk about it is Emma Gray. She's executive women's editor at HuffPost. She joins us from New York. Emma, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Sorry about my tirade there, but I had to get it out of my system. Also with us is Julianne Escobedo Shepherd. She's deputy editor at Jezebel, also in New York. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
Okay. And, you know, I kind of only half apologize for my tirades because this has really got me worked up on a number of different reasons and my feelings are complex. So let me first get the sense from both of you about, it's been several days now that we've all been wrestling with this. What do you think is the most important aspect of the conversation we ought to be focusing on? Emma, I'll just start with you.
Well, first, I think it's impossible to boil this down yeah. to just one point, which is exactly why this conversation is so vital and so important and wonderful, in my view. It is becoming nuanced, and we have to tackle this from multiple perspectives. What I wrote about in the piece that I wrote on this was my own reflection on, after seeing the article come out, the original story, and speaking to women in my own life, and almost every single woman that I spoke to had a story that felt chillingly similar to Grace's. And so it felt to me like this was a moment for us to expand the conversation around sex and sexual assault into sex that might not be criminal but still feels violating, and really unpack why it is that so many women have had these experiences. Mm. And I've been really heartened to see that a lot of people also seem to be willing to delve into this messier gray area.
Yeah, but I mean, messy, I think, is the right word, because even just, I'm sure there are a lot of women listening right now, or men also, who hearing you use the word violative in that context, that's right where they take issue. That's sort of some of the backlash that we've been seeing to this story. And I want to explore more of that with both of you. But Julianne, let me just get your first thoughts here.
Well, you know, I agree with Emma, and I really think that we should be having these conversations, not just about, you know, sex and dating, but about, you know, the power that is often imbalanced in situations with men and women, and like how men can exploit that, even if, as they say, as Aziz Ansari said, they didn't recognize it as such or didn't know. But as I wrote in my piece, the important part is, as journalists, we really have to be responsible with the ways that we present these stories. And that, I think, is why we're not having this conversation as prominently as we should be, because the story itself was just botched from a journalistic standpoint.
And I think that's really problematic, because it's left Grace, even though we don't know exactly who she is because she's using a pseudonym, but it's left her open to all sorts of criticism and attack and undermining of, you know, what I think both of you rightly point out is the bigger, more important conversation we need to be having about sort of the nature of intimacy and how we talk about it and experience it, you know, between people. So, I mean, to the journalistic point, how damaging is that? How has it set back our ability to have these conversations?
I think really what it's done, at least for now, because again, it's only been 3 days, even though it feels like 3 years on the internet. You know, it derails the whole Me Too conversation, I think. You know, we have been having these important conversations in a very public forum, even though I think some journalists like Emma and I have been having them for a long time. But it's wonderful to see the general public sort of opening up to kind of questioning these issues. But, you know, when you bring in a sort of more nuanced gray area example that isn't maybe necessarily the very obvious, you know, Harvey Weinstein powerful exploitation story, you really have to present it in a way that it can be spoken about fairly, because if it isn't, you know, if it's presented messily like this, it just doesn't give us the chance to.
Yeah, I mean, and just to make another point about I will stand fast on my opinion that this is journalistic malpractice, because I was just earlier today reading a 2017 profile of The Tab, the sort of parent company that Babe.net spinned off from, and Joshi Herman at that time, the guy who runs The Tab, you know, told the New York Times that they enjoy recklessly throwing the keys to young editorial people just to see what they come up with, and clicks are what they're all about. Well, they win on that score because we all clicked, but I just don't think you ought to be reckless with people's personal and sensitive stories, or reckless with potentially what the fallout might be.
No, and it's upsettingly opened the subject of this story up to so many more personal attacks than were necessary. Was this story handled with the care that it deserved?
Yeah. So let me get straight to one of the areas beyond the just the gross journalism here, quote unquote journalism. One of the areas that has challenged me the most, and I've got some super brilliant people on my staff who have rightfully looked at me quizzically when I offer these thoughts. So I want to fully acknowledge that it might make some people mad. But what I struggle with is something I think a lot of other people struggle with, that grace in the story seems to come across as hoping or thinking that Aziz Ansari should have recognized her nonverbal cues or her indirect verbal cues that were saying that she feels uncomfortable. I mean, both of you have written about this, so it's not unfamiliar. But you know, intimacy involves a conversation, both verbal and nonverbal. And I struggle with any kind of line of thinking that just abdicates women entirely from their role in that conversation. In other words, I cannot stop thinking what would have happened if she had said clearly, don't want to do this, no, stop, earlier.
Well, I think there's a few points. First, I do think that she employed some soft no's, which research has shown that both men and women are perfectly capable of reading as a lack of consent. She said at one point, I don't want to feel forced. And if you keep doing this, I'm going to start to feel forced. I'm going to hate you. That to me, if I was in the middle of a sexual encounter, would be quite startling. That's not a normal I'm very into it kind of line of speaking. So I think there is, you know, some responsibility to be had on his end. I'm also all for opening up the conversation and encouraging women to articulate our desires and our boundaries more clearly. That's absolutely a part of this conversation. What's upsetting is that I feel like I hear very constantly the question, why didn't she leave? Why didn't she say something? And what we're not really hearing as much is, why didn't he stop?
Right.
Why didn't he check in with her? And I think we need to also hold men to a higher standard. And we need to ask men to be reading their sexual partners, checking in with their sexual partners, and making sure that before they barrel through and continue to try to kind of wear a woman down sexually, that they're making sure that that's what she wants.
Right. There's this notion going around, or this term going around the story, enthusiastic consent. And it goes beyond the idea that, you know, that you just, you know, do the thing. And it goes beyond the idea of even just asking, but understanding that not only are both parties consenting, but they're consenting enthusiastically. And, you know, again, I agree with Emma. There are several points in the story that he should have stopped and he should have asked her how she was feeling. And she told him how she was feeling, but he didn't stop. She stopped. She says that her body tensed up, which, you know, seems like a pretty clear, you know, marker. She stopped kissing him or responding, and he kept going. She said that she didn't want to hate him. And then later he said, "You don't look like you hate me," I believe. Is that the exact
yes.
quote?
Mm-hmm.
You don't seem like you hate me. Yeah. Doesn't seem like you hate me. And that in itself gives me great pause and disturbs me, honestly. And part of the reason that the story upset me is that, you know, it was very similar to instances that I've had, that my friends have had, that, you know, most women I know have had and been sort of stunned, even like, you know, powerful, strong women who in their day to day say no and advocate for this kind of consent. You know, you don't know what is going on in the situation. I think there's more to the story that we just don't know. But I do think that there were several times that Ansari should have ceased what he was doing.
Yeah. We're talking about the Babe.net article outlining that goes into detail about accusations against comedian and actor Aziz Ansari and the conversations that has engendered, and some of the backlash, too. Some people are calling it the next important chapter in the Me Too movement. Others say that it's the story told in the Babe.net article. Maybe shows how women ought to be speaking up more in intimate situations. But I think we ought to be talking more about how we talk about intimacy. So would love to hear from listeners. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. What's your reaction? You can also send me a tweet at Radio Boston. And I'm joined today by Emma Gray. She's executive women's editor at the Huffington Post, and Julianne Escobedo Shepherd. She's deputy editor at Jezebel. Let's get a call here from a guy first. Phil's calling from Natick. You're on the air, Phil.
Hi, how are you? I guess what I took exception to is the description of this as a journalistic failure without really any deference or respect for a victim's voice, which it seems like it's narrated from the victim's voice. And you can't really change the victim's voice or their expression, because that's what criminal cases and that's what is here. It is moving and powerful, but a victim's voice can't be altered after the fact. And to criticize it as a journalistic failure sounds like you wish you could have influenced what was said. And I appreciate your time from Natick, Mass. Thanks.
Hey, Phil, thanks so much for your call. I mean, I just, to clarify my concern about the journalistic failure here is that I don't think enough care was taken to best represent the true meaning and import of what happened to Grace. And in fact, by putting so much salacious detail in the story, it turns into a total distraction from the issues that we ought to really be talking about. And in a way, it trivializes what happened to her. That's the beginnings of my journalistic criticism here. But Julianne, you've written very beautifully about this. Your thoughts?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that what I'm most concerned about, one, is respecting that voice. I think that it is really important that Grace's voice be heard and her, you know, the way she's describing things. I think, you know, obviously she should have that outlet. But the way it was framed, I felt like it took a salacious interest in some of the details of the story in a way that felt exploitive. I also think that, you know, the person who wrote this is quite young, in her early 20s. And so this goes up to the editors. It was an editorial mistake by not showing her the best practices. And that's why I think the whole thing feels so salacious and damaging, because it feels not just like exploiting Grace, but also exploiting young emerging journalists.
Yeah. Let's get another call here from Kelly, who's calling from Milford. You're on the air, Kelly.
Hi. I just want to say I totally agree with you. I just think at some point as women, we need to stop looking at men to kind of hold our hand and read our cues. Like, we are strong enough to say what we want and say what we feel. And if we keep backpedaling on it, it distracts from this movement that is supposed to empower women. So if at the same time we want to blame him for not understanding when she tensed up or whatever she did, she could have left. So I just think I was in the military for 8 years in operation or career field. So being a strong woman is important, but at the same time, you have to speak up because people can't read your mind. It's not just going to be that clear to everybody and anybody.
Hey, Kelly, let me just ask you a quick question before you put the phone down here. I mean, you don't have to tell me about your personal life, but I'm just wondering, like, if you put yourself in the situation that Grace found herself and you thought that you were, you know, you were communicating your desires or your limits, and though, and maybe that communication wasn't happening, or you didn't see the other party respond appropriately to those communications, I mean, what would you do when you thought you were saying what your intent was?
I would leave. I mean, we're all free to move about as we please. It's not like he was holding her captive or kidnapped her. Uber's there for all of us, taxis. I mean, at no point should she have felt that she was constrained to be in his domicile. She should have left.
Yeah. Kelly, thank you so much for your call. Emma, what's your thought on what she had to say?
I understand where she's coming from. I also think that it's more complex than that. We have to take into account the power dynamics here. This is a woman who was a decade younger than Aziz Ansari. She's in a celebrity's apartment. She was clearly interested in him and hoped that it would go well. And you can see her kind of grappling, trying to kind of take back that narrative. She hopes that they'll just hang out. And he continues to say to her, yeah, let's just hang out with our clothes on. We'll just watch TV. And then it continues to escalate. And that's a very confusing situation for anyone to find themselves in. And I also think that demanding that we raise the bar on men's behavior does not mean abdicating responsibility as women. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be communicating, again, our desires and boundaries. It just means that we can make demands on men as well. And I think it's insulting to men to assume that they don't have the capability to check in with and read their sexual partners.
Yeah, no, totally agreed here. So this question of power, because that's going to come up a lot, and it's one of the central points of what we need to explore here. Julianne, if you don't mind, I'm just going to quote a little bit from your Jezebel article. Oh, and by the way, folks listening, Emma and Julianne have really written very intelligently about this, and we have links to their articles at our website, radioboston.org. But what Julianne, there's a part in your article where you wrote that even if Ansari were not a famous man, the fact that Grace perceived him to possess enough power that she felt coerced is a statement about the ways women are conditioned, even with decades of entrenched feminism, to concede to that perceived power. Now, mm-hmm. my question for you is about this question of, is about perception. It's about Grace's right. perception of power. I mean, maybe we ought to encourage women to change their perceptions of power and therefore not relinquish the power in a situation like this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I also think that, you know, we still, even as much as we try, and as long as, you know, the feminist movement has been at the forefront of American politics, men are still afforded with a disproportionate amount of power. And so even if we all change ourselves as we are trying to reclaim a narrative and trying to exert our agency, we're still bombarded with the actual fact of men having more social, political, and cultural power than us. And so, you know, I think that is a huge factor. Obviously, we can't know exactly how that played out in Grace's mind and in this situation. But I think that is, you know, an overarching umbrella topic that we always need to consider in this.
Let's take another call here on this point. Jeff is calling from Boston. You're on the air, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Meghna. Great show. I just wanted to talk about this Babe article as being a really terrible example of the kind of, you know, communication and consent that goes on between men and women because of that power imbalance. You know, there's been a collusion that goes on between men and women going back centuries where men in power, you know, start to have an expectation of maybe some sexual interaction. And, you know, women have gone along with that, too. And so there is a power dynamic. If you want to remove that and then talk about what's involved in verbal and nonverbal consent. But this power dynamic and collusion between men and women has been going on for as long as we've existed. And that's something that really needs to be broken down.
Jeff, thank you so much for your call. Let's take another one here because the lines are full. Sarah is calling from Newton. You're on the air, Sarah.
Hi. In my social circle, everyone has been so on board with the Me Too until this article, and it's been so disheartening to hear what people are saying that suddenly they're, like, not on board with it. I thought the best thing I read about it yesterday was Lindy West's piece in the New York Times. I was hoping that your guest could speak a little bit about this idea that an affirmative consent is not a new idea, and it's been around for a really long time, and so that is a wrong claim that some people are making.
Yeah. Sarah, thank you so much for your call. Emma and Julianne, chime in.
Affirmative consent absolutely is not new. As Julianne kind of alluded to earlier, in our corner of the internet and journalism, we've been having these conversations for years, for decades. And I think that it is intellectually dishonest to suggest that this is a new concept. And for people who are just coming to it, you know, welcome. That's why we need to have these conversations.
As Emma wrote really beautifully, the idea that this conversation ceases with what is legally actionable and the law is, I think a disservice. We have to talk about, Jeff, power structures and the conditioning of the past, all of humanity. But we have been talking about this. And so, it's interesting to see that sort of to see people stop right at this grace, this line that isn't, prosecutable.
Right.
And also, I mean, what has happened to Aziz? Nothing.
So, Emma, do you mind if there's a question I want to ask you on this line that comes right out of the story that you wrote. Your story, I actually think, was very brave because you gave some of your own examples. And so all due respect, but there is a question that I have coming out of one of your stories. Okay, so I just want to treat this the right way. You recounted an experience that you had with a man and you weren't quite into it. He went to the bathroom. He comes back and engages in certain activity that you didn't really love. And after about 10 seconds, you said he asked you, "Is this okay?" And then you said you just felt frozen and you didn't want to make a scene or embarrass him or end up looking crazy, that it just felt easier to say, yeah. So my question, and again, with the utmost respect that you were brave enough to share your story, is aren't those also exactly the moments where, even though it's easier just to say yeah, we as women have to face the hard thing and do the difficult thing and say no?
I absolutely wish that I had felt empowered in that moment not to freeze and to articulate my boundaries more clearly. And I say that in the piece as well. Again, this isn't such a simple black and white conversation as men, why did you do this? Women, you have no responsibility. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I do have questions about why someone would, after we had communicated that the evening had come to an end, come back, physically stand over me. I was laying down and he was physically standing over me. I'm a small person. He was larger. And start a sexual act and then ask for consent. So I put responsibility on myself for just saying yeah. And I also put responsibility on him for sort of asking for consent in what I feel is a bit of a misleading and dishonest way.
Yeah.
And I think part of that goes back to this socialization, the fact that women receive messages from a very, very, very young age that our needs and desires come second, that we should always be for our own, self-protection, be modulating our behavior around the comfort of the people around us, specifically men. And men receive the message that they must be the sexual aggressors, that to be manly is to kind of barrel through a woman's coyness until she acquiesces. And this hurts men and it hurts women, because I can imagine it being incredibly terrifying to have a sexual interaction that you think was fine and then find out later that the other person found it to be violating. I have empathy for that as well. And that's why I think we need to have this conversation, because these sexual scripts aren't working for anyone.
Yeah, no, I mean, a point well made. But I wanted to bring up this example because you can see why so much of the resistance to Grace's story falls along the same lines. Again, you were brave enough to say, hey, there was this thing that happened, and after 10 seconds, he asked me if it's okay, and you didn't say no. And there's just a lot of people who are like, well, if that's the case, then a woman can't go back later and say it felt yucky, and so therefore it's his fault. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Like, that's the source, I think, of a lot of the pushback that we've been seeing in all manner of think pieces and TV and radio and online.
And I understand that, but I think sex is more complicated than just who did the worst thing.
Yeah.
I think if the goal is for everyone's sexual boundaries to be respected, articulated well, and for everyone to enjoy themselves in sexual encounters, then we have to be willing to dive into, as I say, those gray areas. And it's not about playing the blame game. It's about breaking down what do these scripts that have been ingrained in all of us from essentially birth, how do they play out in adulthood, and how can we make everyone's sex lives better ultimately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. I want to get some more calls in here if I could. Shannon is calling from Everett. You're on the air, Shannon.
Hi. I wanted to call in from a perspective from a bunch of my male friends that as the Me Too movement has come along, I keep checking in with them on like how is it perceived from the male eyes of how do I articulate while I'm trying to be romantic and be perceived as manly and masculine? How do I initiate sex, keep a mood, but then check in, try and read subtle cues? And as a consensus, all of them are like, I'm okay if you're direct with me, but they're terrible at reading the more subtle cues. And so as this whole movement has begun, I hear lots of accusations and lots of protectiveness surrounding sexual situations, but not as many like actionable resources.
Yeah.
Men who have right. the heart to change, they're like, just tell me what to do and I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
In an actionable way, because all the emotional things, that's just not their wheelhouse.
Shannon, so great point. I'm gonna take it back from you because I want to let Emma and Julianne respond. Your thoughts, Julianne?
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I think most women I know are also on the same page as that just be direct. And I think that asking if something is okay, you know, is as direct as you can get. I think, yes, I agree that, you know, ostensibly, intellectually, when we're all clothed, it's great to talk about how women should be able to say no. But at the same time, I think that we need to make this conversation more equitable. And we do want men in on the conversation. And we want them to also bear some of the burden. So if, you know, women, you know, take it upon ourselves to say no, exactly no, hard line no in the moment, they should also take it upon themselves to say, hey, do you want to do this? Or, you know, is this cool even?
And that can be sexy.
Right.
It doesn't have to be so clinical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get another call in here. Lindsay is calling from Natick. You're on the air, Lindsay.
Hi. I just had sort of a comment about what you guys were talking about before, about how, you know, women are sort of trained to be subservient. And, you know, growing up in the education field, it's like we take sex ed classes and it's all about the internal workings of our bodies. And what can we do to sort of empower younger women to start, you know, reaching out in their sexuality, what's important for them and what feels good to them and what's okay with them? Like, how do we approach that?
Lindsay, thank you so much. Emma, Julianne, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think this is such a key point. Comprehensive sexual education is a great way into this. It's incredibly necessary, and as a country, we really, really fail at it. And one of the most interesting points that was brought up to me when I was doing interviews around this was for a woman who treats sexual abusers, actually. And she really stressed that what we need to do is we need to incorporate consent and intimacy in relationships into early childhood skill building. She compared it to the way that we might teach a child to look both ways before you cross the street. We teach our children skills. Let's teach them about consent and intimacy and relationships and communication.
Well, we are speaking with Emma Gray. She's executive women's editor at Huffington Post, and with Julianne Escobedo Shepherd, who is deputy editor at Jezebel. And we are talking about the Aziz Ansari babe.net story and all that it's unleashed about sexual expectations, about intimacy, about how we communicate with each other, about, well, everything. 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Definitely want to hear from as many listeners as possible. So give us a call or you can send me a tweet at Radio Boston. Emma and Julianne, I just want to shift gears a tiny bit here a little bit and talk about what seems to be, in terms of the reaction to this story, a kind of significant age divide. First of all, I got this tweet from someone who calls herself Mama Snowflake, and she says, thanks for having this conversation. I'm in my 50s, so perhaps have a different perspective than younger women, but I lament the anonymous account that names names seems to be unfair to Aziz Ansari. And then also, as you guys well know, there is a Caitlin Flanagan in The Atlantic wrote a pretty scathing piece about Grace. It was very, very strong. And she also appeared recently on NPR. And here's what she had to say.
Then in this one core area, they're so weak, which is they jump into these, you know, hookup situations. I have zero moralistic comment on that. And then they become terrified to say the thing that we were taught right away. Don't kiss me if I don't want to be kissed. I absolutely refuse. I'm walking out of here.
So that was Caitlin Flanagan on NPR. I just was wondering what you and Emma, you and Julianne think about. Is there an age divide here? A difference in how women, depending on their generation, view this issue?
To an extent, I think that exists, but I also think it's a bit simplistic to distill it down just to age. I've spoken to a lot of women of all ages who have an incredibly wide spread of opinions on this. I do understand that there might be a natural defensiveness, a feeling of if you have lived through years in the workforce, years in the dating world, and you look back and you recognize some experiences you've had in Grace's story and you don't feel traumatized or violated by those things. I understand the impulse to say, well, don't tell me that what I experienced was worse than I felt it to be. But I also think that young women are in a position where they are just stepping into these arenas.
Yeah.
And they almost have the freedom to renegotiate the terms and the space to say, to imagine a world where maybe their sexual encounters don't have to look like this.
So this brings me back to perception and expectation, because there was this YouGov poll, a survey but through The Economist and YouGov. And one of the interesting findings that they had, I mean, you can take polling, take it or leave it, but one of the things that they found is that more than a third of millennial men and women say that if a man compliments a woman's looks, it's harassment. So I think to a lot of people's ears, that sounds like, well, if that's the perception and expectation that you're coming into an intimate relationship with, there's going to be problems no matter what.
I would like to see the data on that poll, because it frankly sounds absurd. And I don't know if that's necessarily a prevailing idea among millennials. Also, I think that, you know, they didn't specify how a woman compliments on her looks. I mean, I think that this generation has focused a lot on catcalling and the way that that plays out on the street. You know, I think, you know, the term wolf whistle used to be accepted and people would just be like, oh, well, that's just how people talk to you on the street. Well, guess what? We don't want to be talked to on the street that way. And now we're questioning it and challenging it. And so I think that, you know, like Emma said, we have this opportunity to make the world more equitable. And I think that's what women of older generations wanted as well. And just because our idea of equitable is different from theirs doesn't necessarily mean that we're turning into some sort of, moralistic, finger wagging, rigid life community.
Well, we're just about out of time here, and I'm actually going to give the last thought to one of our listeners who sent me this tweet, Alexa Golden. She says, agreed, it's so important to teach consent to little kids. I try to always ask a kid for a high five because I want them to take ownership of their bodies and learn early on to give a yes or no. So Emma Gray, executive women at, women's editor at Huffington Post, and Julianne Escobedo Shepherd, deputy editor at Jezebel. This has been such a great conversation. I can't thank both of you enough. Thank you so very much.
This was a delight.
It was a delight. Thank you so much, Magda.
And listeners, there were a lot of you who didn't get on the air, so go to radioboston.org and put your comments there, because this is an important conversation that we want to keep going. And while you're there, check out the links to Emma's and Julianne's great writing about this topic. Let's keep talking. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.